Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. And you know that if you play, let's say, Madonna's song from 20 years ago on a YouTube video of yours in the background while you're dancing to it, you know, that's a copyright violation. But it turns out if it goes on for 15, 20 seconds, Google won't even flag it. YouTube would just allow it to go up and probably stay there. Well, joining me is an entrepreneur who said, I think I could do better than Google. You're smiling, right? Because I'm on the right track with what you're doing, right? He goes, look, I think what I could do is let Madonna's people know, even if it's 15 seconds of music that was played, if it belongs to her and she wants to do something about it, I could help her get paid. And ditto for small creators who need the money much more than these more established people. And in order to do that, what he decided to do was, I'm guessing, this is just a hunch based on a little bit of research that I did, you're scraping the internet for music. You're nodding. I told you I need the video of you so I can get a sense of whether I'm on the right track. He's pulling in data from YouTube, from Facebook, from SoundCloud. If you invented some video publishing platform yesterday, there's a good chance his software has sucked in all the music from it so that he understands what's on there. Anyway, what he enables creators to do is say, ah, that's my music, that's my video, it's being played there, maybe I deserve some money for it, and here's how I can do it. Now, the world is changing in Europe significantly, and he's got a product that he's creating to help creators there. I'm going to ask him to talk about that, but first we're going to get to know him, we're going to get to know the time that he didn't have the smile on his face, where he nearly went bankrupt. And we're going to find out how he built up this company to the point where it is today. The person whose face I'm looking at and you're not looking at him is Rusty Turek. He is the founder of PEX. I love your domain, three-letter domain, PEX.com, P-E-X. It's a database of all the video and audio on the internet. We're going to find out how he built up this database. We're going to find out how he came up with the business idea. We're going to find out about his early entrepreneurship career at a time when it was barely legal to be an entrepreneur. And we can do it thanks to two phenomenal sponsors. The first, if you need a developer to do amazing things for you that'll make you proud the way that Rusty is right now smiling at me whenever I talk about what he's created, you got to go to TopTal, and I'll tell you about TopTal.com/Mixergy later. And if you haven't built a website and you need a hosting company, go to HostGator.com/Mixergy. But again, I'll talk about those later. Rusty, good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
I love the pride that you have in your work. Was there ever a time with PEX that you didn't have this pride, this smile on your face?
Well, I will say most of the time.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It was very hard to build.
Let's start off, since we've got so much that's going well. Let's start off with the time that wasn't going well. December 2017, you published an article about how you nearly went bankrupt.
So one of the challenges of this company is it started in 2014. In fact, February 14, 2014, I realized 3 years later when I was signing some paperwork that we started on Valentine's Day. Somehow I didn't notice at that time. First 3 years were very, very tough because none of the investors were willing to touch the company, mostly because they essentially looked at what we do. They looked at UGC, user-generated content. At that point, there were few platforms, YouTube, Vimeo, Dailymotion. Most of those people barely know at this point. Facebook, Instagram, and many others, including Twitter, didn't have any media outside of images. And it didn't look like video is going to be such a big deal or music on the internet is going to be such a big deal. And so when I started with this company and started telling people, it's like, look, UGC is going to be big. Their abuse is going to be growing, and eventually there will be an opportunity not only for us, but for the creators to venture out and start building their brands on the internet without the major, you know, labels and rights holders. Most investors kind of scoffed at it and said, not for me.
Well, what was the business model that you were presenting to them with that vision of the future of user-generated content being so big, UGC?
It was the same as we have it today. So essentially a search engine for audiovisual content that is exposed to the rights holders. We're based on the infringements or essentially the indemnifications they can take advantage of that situation, meaning, you know, take down content that they don't like, forms of mixes and remixes of their content, or monetize in addition to what they have. So we always believe that the virality on the internet is very important to general marketing and kind of a growth of a brand. But at the same time, it should be not unhinged and done however it fits, right? And so we wanted to give tools to the rightsiders to manage this growth and manage this spread in the directions that will make the most sense to their own business.
Meaning a musician creates a song. If other people use it, you said it's going to happen, but the musician should get some money for it. A comedian creates a comedy sketch and other people start to use it. That comedian should get some money or something for that, right? Some attribution.
At least the credit. So it's not about money per se, but the credit is important, right? So this person put their heart and soul into it, and then people take it, put it on their own, you know, pages on Facebook or on their own channels on YouTube, and pretend that they done most of this work. And it's not just small creators, right? It's like very big names abuse rights quite significantly and often, which is terrible for the true creators that essentially put so much work into it. And what is challenging for them, it's not only that they are not being given the credit, but they don't usually know about it. They don't know about this audience, right? So it's very hard for them to build a product for audience. Like I always say, imagine that you have a pizza shop where you interacted one of 100 of your customers. How would you know what they really want? You just create pizza based on maybe demand, but how would you know, how would you be creative if you cannot talk to your audience? And this is the problem. Once the content starts spreading without you, you don't know where it goes. It enters new communities without your participation.
Okay, so that was what you pitched to investors. Did you raise money at that point?
They did not.
You did not raise any money. And is that why you were getting close to bankruptcy?
Well, not really. So I started putting my own money in. We were a very small team back in San Francisco. We spent many years building. And the challenge was we couldn't find any customers because all customers said, come back when you have the whole YouTube. The problem is YouTube is quite large. And so we always said, well, we have a subset of YouTube process to date. Maybe we can start there. But they said we want the whole YouTube or nothing.
Give me an example of a customer. Give me an example of a customer that you would have talked to who said that.
From sports league like NHL, NBA, NFL.
So you went to the NFL, for example, or one of these customers, and you said, there are people who are putting up your highlight clips on their YouTube channel. I could find some of them for you. I don't know all. And they said, until you tell me all, it's not useful. They didn't even want to go after the people who were you could find. No. Why not?
The problem with rightsiders is they are not usually technical. And so generally what they care about is like, do you have a large upside in the business in some form or shape? And usually what that means is like the departments for what they call anti-piracy are tiny. Usually they have a lower budget than the toilet paper that they spend for the whole company. Usually this is one or two people essentially tasked with protection. So for Hollywood studio that has $8 billion budget, the anti-piracy is two people. Imagine that you have a $100 million movie and essentially two people are charged in protecting itself through, you know, throughout the lifetime of the movie. And so there was never enough interest and money in that department. And so the only way for us to make any kind of business was or marketing, meaning helping them to understand the virality of the content, how it spreads, where it goes. And for that, you need to have at least majority of the content rather than minority. Or the other alternative was where we can bring upside, which is the additional monetization. And that is interesting, but at the same time, it still requires certain scale. And so most of the customers were essentially very skeptical, mostly because this was pitched to them ad nauseum in the past and nobody really delivered. Everybody promised, but nobody really brought it in. And then in addition, they were not willing to invest their time and energy into a company that was maybe going to get there. The challenge was, if we couldn't do that, in order to do that, we needed money, right? To scrape the whole YouTube is not cheap. So we went to investors and said, but look, we have these all promising businesses that could actually work with us. You need to give us money. We will be able to sign them. And they essentially told us, I will give you money when you sign them. So we were in this beautiful chicken and egg for over 3 years. And it started getting to a point that we were actually able to, with my savings and with some smarts, able to do what we needed to do. So bring essentially vast majority of the content to the platform. And from there, we were able to finally convince first major investor that was actually looking at us, but they were petrified that the crawling is essentially illegal from the legal perspective, and then that the platforms will sue us. And so we spent, I will say, almost 9 months of due diligence where they were looking for experts to figure this out. And when finally they were comfortable, they issued the term sheet and all of these things. However, their board refused to sign the term sheet, the last piece of paper. So we were not able to raise the money from them. And we had $500,000 debt to $500,000 to our lawyers. And so at that point, we were essentially dead, as good as dead. And by a sheer coincidence, a customer that we were talking to for years, that we essentially told, we are going out of business. You have last 2 weeks, because we have last 2 weeks of operational capacity. You have last 2 weeks to see how this really works. If you want, it costs you nothing. It's completely free. You don't have to do anything. And they said yes. And within a week, from what they were able to see, they not only decided to sign a deal with us, but also invested money themselves. And from there we go. And
because you let them try it for free. You said, look, I only have a couple of weeks anyway. You might as well get this for free. And if you like it, maybe you could buy. Who's the company?
Universal Music. And what was very, very challenging for everybody to understand is this is the largest rights holder in the music. Usually it takes very long time to get them to do anything. And these happen in orders of few days. And they doubled down on us and allowed us to actually continue. And so thanks to them, we are around. But once they signed, the whole industry started paying attention. And we were able to sign all of their major competitors within a very short period of time, which pushed our revenue from zero to multi-million dollars very, very quickly, which then confused all of the investors that passed on us in the past, which was in hundreds, by the way. I spoke to 450 people in 3.5 years, and every single one said no. And by the time we grew so much, we were getting literally swamped with term sheets where people were confused by how is this even possible. So
there's so much I want to break down in here. The first thing is, when you were going through that near bankruptcy situation, you would do what to keep your head on right? Go for walks?
Run.
A lot. What was this whole running thing that you did?
I wake up every morning, 5:50, go for a run, and run up until I cry, and then
literally
you go by your day. Yeah.
Where would you go running?
Nothing else to do. Mission Bay, from Mission Bay, San Francisco, up to South Salido.
Wow. And so that's like right over the bridge, right?
Yeah, that's 14 miles. It's a very nice.
And you'd literally cry.
Well, there is nothing else left.
Thinking what? Thinking I'm a failure. I disappointed my dad. Where do you go in your head when it gets so bad that you cry?
I don't think it's about disappointing others. It's about that this was my seventh endeavor. And so first three companies I was able to sell, but the last three I had to close because I was just not able to do well with them. And so this was a pattern at this point. And it was convincing me that I just maybe don't have what is needed for this. And, you know, it is very emotional. And more emotional than this, that the company is not working, was the people that were leaving, right? So nobody wants to stay in a sinking ship.
Yeah.
And so we will have people quitting essentially on a weekly basis. And we were very, very, very small team. And the people that say, you know, I don't believe in this anymore and I would just want to do something else, it's hard.
Yeah, the post that you wrote all those years ago said, I had to force myself not to look at my phone before I went for those runs, because if I did, something terrible would be in my inbox that would keep me from going out, like somebody saying, I'm sorry. And you knew instantly, that means no run for me. This person's leaving. The other thing that I'm wondering is, I asked you, how can I make this interview useful for you? You said, I don't know. There's nothing that I need right now. And I'm actually not even super comfortable talking to you. This is not what I get off on. It turns out you and I you're smiling because you wouldn't have done this interview with me if not for a guy named Josh Burek, who's teaching at the Harvard Kennedy School. He made an introduction so that I could have you on here. as I'm thinking about you not especially eager to have the world know your name and do this interview and get publicity and all that, I'm wondering, are you the guy who would call up Universal? Are you the person who's calling up the NFL? Are you the person who was making call after call after call and trying to pitch yourself? Or was there someone else who was doing it?
No, it's me. It's there was no one else left. So it was always me.
Were you good at that? Or was that something that was difficult?
I think the fact that we signed them all over the years proves that I must be at least somehow good, right?
Okay. Did you enjoy it?
But it's a process. I mean, one of our customers took 19 months to sign. And those are active discussion, right? And so it takes very, very long time to get multi-billion dollar companies to sign multi-million dollar contracts with a company of four people. And there is not just a lot of convincing, but it's a lot of work that you have to put into the relationship. And I might not be bad at it, considering that we were able to sign essentially everybody that matters within the music industry.
What was your check? What was your trick, I was saying, but what's your technique? What was your process for getting to them and closing sales with them?
It's building relationships, making sure that we are helpful to the person that actually operationally runs with it. So usually in large companies, especially large deals are signed with the CFOs or at least very high up. However, the person that is going to interact with you is like 14 levels below them. And usually what a lot of folks will do is like they try to cater to the CFO, go top down. We try to always go from both directions. Show the CFO, show the leadership that this is valuable, but also be there for the people that actually are going to be utilizing it day to day.
The thing is that you didn't have investors who would make introductions to them. I don't see you as the guy who's sitting on LinkedIn, hunting email addresses, pinging them with cold email. Is that, what was your process?
That's exactly what I did. In fact, I learned in the United States, so as you can tell by my accent, I'm not from this country. You're one email away from anyone in this country. Truly, you can reach out to anyone and up until you're helpful to them, up until there is a value, they will respond. And it applies to people from Jeff Bezos down to the last person in this country.
Up Who's until the most you impressive person you got? Or the most surprising, toughest one that you still reached out to and got because of email?
I mean, we actually raised some money because we cold emailed some investors over the years. But I mean, I know the CEOs of the biggest rights holders at this point, and those were a lot of times cold emails. And
just cold emails, you know, from you.
Well, one of the things is this is similar to a beautiful person when you are in a dance floor, right? There is a boy or girl that they are very pretty. The challenge with them is like nobody is actually approaching them because everybody's scared of them. So big companies are kind of like that. Like nobody reaches out to a CEO of Universal because you know that they are going to say no. But that's not how the world is. They actually are kind of yearning to be around startups. And so I was able to get a lunch with Bob Iger because of exactly this thing.
Bob Iger?
Yeah, I got introduced to him by a complete random coincidence. And my favorite part was my name, Rusty, that I shortened to Rusty, and my company, Pex, unfortunately autocompletes to something very different. So when Bob Iger was making introduction to his folks, introduced me as a tasty from sex. So that was memorable. But even to him, I got through just cold emailing people. I cold emailed one of the people on his staff and I said, I can be very helpful to your company. And here is why. And here is all of the work that we did prior without you asking. You don't have to pay for anything for it. And they thought that it's valuable enough.
I guess I should say that he ran Disney for the years where they bought Lucas, where they bought just at the beginning of Pixar and when, of course, they launched Disney Plus. But what did you do that was helpful for Disney before they even asked you for it?
Well, we were able to show the essentially based on the trailers virality, how they are going to play in the box office. So we started doing these reports for based on other movies. And so we benchmarked it essentially against others and it was quite close. And it was based on trailer data on a UGC platform 6 months before a box office. And so that was valuable enough for them to warrant a meeting.
Meaning you could show that people were posting their videos on Twitter, on Facebook, that type of thing?
Yeah, so what essentially happens is there is a difference between popularity and virality. I think people misuse these words or kind of use them they use them essentially just as a replacement for each other. But the reality is popularity is how much certain things gives us traffic of some sort. So you can think of radio. So one radio playing the same song over and over that will make it popular within that radio. Viral means how far it spreads. So all of the radios playing the same song, that's viral. So in the UGC world, in the online world of video and audio, what this means is Taylor Swift having a 2 billion views on YouTube, that makes it popular. 15 million copies of that song across all of these platforms makes it viral. Because essentially virality, you can take it from the audience. Popularity is about how deeply you break into the audience that you have relationship with. So for instance, your subscribers, your listeners, that's your popularity. So if you have 100,000 subscribers and 90,000 of them are actually watching what you produced, that's your popularity. It's quite high, right? Or mailing or opening of mailing newsletters, that's your popularity. Virality is about how far it spreads, which also means how other communities you are interacting with that you don't have direct relationship with. And so what we did with these trailers, we took five other movies. We took five other movies, their trailers, and we looked at the virality. That means how far those trailers went. We separated into true UGC and then own channels and then also editorial, which is all of these, you know, Variety, the Hollywood Reporter and such. And then we broke them down into these categories and we were able to show how these movies are essentially aligning with each other. So it's like things like Thor, how it aligns with, for instance, something against DC Comics and such. And so we were able to show them how most likely the movie is going to play out at the cinema, at the box office, which is one of the biggest things that the movie studios really want. And so we were so close with one of the Thor movies, which was the report that we did for, that they essentially started talking to us right after that. And so this got to Bob Iger because I didn't reach out to the marketing department. I reached out to his people and he saw it first before anyone else. And so he thought that this was interesting enough that he invited me for lunch at their executive dining room, which was kind of cool.
That's amazing. All right, I'm going to talk about my first sponsor and then I want to find out how you got to scrape all the data on YouTube. Is it legal? How could you possibly do it without Google shutting you down? And then we'll get into what happened next in your story. But first, if anyone is listening to you and says to themselves, you know what, that is the power of a real amazing developer. Really, this isn't 10x developer, right? We're talking 20x developer. This is where TopTal comes in. You and I both know the co-founders of TopTal. We talked before the interview started. We know them in like a San Francisco way where you get to know people a lot because you live here, but you're not like intimate personal friends with anybody because we're all working. Do you go out a lot here even now in San Francisco? Are you in San Francisco still?
I am actually in Salt Lake City right now. We moved from San Francisco to LA 3 years ago, so not really that much.
Okay. Well, I'm still here and I don't get to see people that often, but a lot of the relationships I made when I could before COVID are still paying off right now. Anyway, the bottom line is you could get to know an amazing 10, 20x developer by meeting people, waiting for introductions. Hopefully, maybe you dormed with them in college, or when you're really ready for this kind of transformational development work on your site, on your idea, on your software, you could just go to TopTal. That's where they specialize. Nobody ever said, I got this great deal from TopTal, a dollar developer from Hong Kong, or, well, you don't get it from Hong Kong, dollar developer from Eastern Europe. This person is super cheap. No, what you say is, I got this person. They totally transformed the business. They did what, this is what work they used to do for Google. Now they did it for me. Everything is different now because of them. If you're ready to have that kind of conversation, all you have to do is go to toptal.com/mixergy. You press the big button on their site. You'll schedule a call with a matcher where you'll tell them what your idea is, what your project is, what part of your business hasn't gone where you need it to go. And with a consultation from them, they'll tell you whether they have a developer for you or not. Truthfully, a lot of times they say to my audience, sorry, it's not a good fit. But if it is a good fit, they can get you in front of a couple of amazing developers or development teams who've often done the work that you're dying to get done and don't know if it's even possible. They've done it. And if you decide to hire them, you could get started very quickly so you don't have to go through the whole slog of trying to hire people. Use my URL and you get 80 hours of developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours in addition to a no-risk trial period. And that special URL is toptal.com/mixergy. I'll spell it for you because I talk very fast. That's TOPTAL toptal.com/mixergy, toptal.com/mixergy. How do you scrape everything from Google, from YouTube, without having them shut you down?
Well, it's something that you learn over the years, but you know, we had some luck, we had some technical capabilities. And it was a process. It takes time. It's, in fact, one of the challenging parts about scraping so much data is not that it's costly. It's that there, the pipes don't carry that much data anymore, right? So essentially, the pipes are usually maxed out at this point by people watching Netflix, YouTube, and others. And so there is only so much traffic that you can bring in. And so it's a process. It took us multiple years to bring it down. And YouTube did fight us quite hard to stop us from doing these kind of things. Unfortunately for them, I will say, they were usually using technical measures rather than legal. And by the time they were be ready to actually take legal measures, we were already so big and representing such a large rights holders that at this point, it will be very challenging for them to explain to the rights holders why are they preventing them from actually seeing all of these stuff. So
what were you doing to get them? Were you using Amazon servers all over the place? Did you put your own servers all over the world? What did you do?
We used Google to scrape Google.
What do you mean use Google to scrape Google?
Google Cloud. So we used Google Cloud. It's coming because I am ex-Googler. And so I grew up on that internally. I grew up on the technology. And so I was able to figure out how to do these things quite simply and easily, and we were able to scale well. And plus,
I know a lot of security engineer at Google.
I was security engineer at
Google for 2 years, and so you know a lot of people. You were about to say before I interrupted you.
Exactly, I knew a lot of people, so I was able to pull lots of favors internally.
Is there an example of something that you did that you can talk about now?
Well, I mean, it's mostly that we got access to Weber. I mean, tiny little company, and we were treated like we are a behemoth internally at the GCP level, and the GCP group was really, really nice to us. And so we had access to all of these essentially alpha versions of all of these new services that were coming out. We got extreme amounts of credit from them because they were, you know, they wanted us to be on their platform, and they used us quite heavily for promotions to show what small team was able to do at scale.
What do you mean? Google Cloud was so in favor of you being on their platform to show what could be done that they helped you also find a way to scrape YouTube.
Yes. And then YouTube was very, very, very angry about all of that. So it was an interesting situation. But
because internally they don't know about each other. You know, I had a friend, got a job at Google, decided it wasn't for him. And frankly, I think even Google just let go of that department. They said, we don't love it either. He said, go walk around for a few weeks, figure out what you like. You just go sit in different departments, including the self-driving car department, which is now Waymo. I then thought based on that, that they were all kind of working together. If one group can hire him, someone else pays him, and then he gets to walk around through whatever group he wants to, it feels like it's like they're working well together. From your story, it seems like they're siloed and they don't know what they're each doing.
I think they do work together, but not as closely. Also, Google has over 100,000 people. So it's very hard. Even when I was there, we were, you know, a few tens of thousands. And I usually get asked, do you know this guy? Well, it's like saying, do you know this person from San Francisco? It's like the likelihood is very low.
Yeah, I do notice that a lot. Smart people will, if you say, I work at Facebook, they'll say, do you know this person? And I think what they're hoping is that you'll like them and feel connected.
You validate
to them
exactly.
Yeah, validation.
Yes.
Okay, so that's how you did that. You were taking a risk. You then moved on to other platforms. What's the next platform you moved on to?
I think Facebook was the second. I mean, we are now past 50, I believe. 50 different platforms. Now the adding a new platform for us is a question maybe of 4 hours or so. And so it's very easy. The system is very well developed and it's very low friction process. But initially a lot of these things were by hand and we had to pay attention if they changed the platform, we had to change the scrapers and stuff. And they fought us constantly. They put reCAPTCHA and other blocking mechanism in front. And so we had to do a lot of different things to essentially not be stopped from what we were doing. And
you created software that circumvented their CAPTCHAs that basically typed in "I'm a human" in a way that looked like a human. Found the bus when they do their CAPTCHA bus, find the bus thing. Yes. You did that.
I can tell you, we did that. I can tell you our team was very happy when we finally finished labeling our data where people are seeing hydrants in their dreams.
Yeah. Why does Google want fire hydrants so much in those CAPTCHAs?
It's just what they are doing is essentially they are using, it's called games with purpose. So what they are doing is they take data from Straight View, and you help them to annotate them for them. So essentially they take pictures of random parts of the Street View, and they say, like, is there a fire hydrant in there? Is there a traffic light? Is there a taxi in there? And so you essentially go yes and no, yes and no. And because you have 4 billion people online or 3 billion people online and a few billion times a day, people say yes and no, then they actually process massive amounts of data for Google.
I get that, but I understand why Google might want to know where traffic lights are. Why do they care so much about fire hydrants?
I don't know. I mean, maybe they will help you with parking.
All right. So you built the first version. It was time to start to build a team. Now that you're making money, how'd you do that? How'd you go about hiring? Where'd you get the advice on how to set together a team?
Yeah, we did a lot of, I'm not really good with advice. I am the person that does and learns on their own mistakes. So we did a lot of our mistakes at that point. So we wanted to scale the team, obviously. So we started hiring some people. Hiring in the Bay Area, especially for a startup that is non-venture funded, it's very tough, very, very tough, especially when the technology is very complicated and requires a significant amount of work. And so we were not able to compete with Google, Facebook, and others. In fact, in most cases, they outbid us by 7 to 10x. And that tells you a lot.
Yeah.
And so that was one of the reasons why we packed everything and moved. The whole company essentially moved to LA, where we thought we have a better chance, and we eventually did. And then we started paying attention to things that people say you're supposed to pay attention, but we thought we don't have to, like culture. And so we started, you know, reading books, trying to figure out what's the best way. We tried to emulate other companies that never worked out, that people failed. And then we went with the most common sense thing that we believed is the right one. And fortunately, we were eventually able to figure out the process that actually worked for us. And I must say, in last 6.5 years of the company, only 5 people left us.
What's the culture that, what books helped you create your culture? And what's the culture that you think helps you hire?
I don't know about one book. I think it's a series of books, obviously. The Bibles of Silicon Valley, for like high output management by Andy Grove. I think if you walk into Silicon Valley, it's like in Alaska. You walk into Alaska, you get check. Walk into Silicon Valley, you get this book. And so that was definitely a big one. I don't know about like books that are focused on hiring or management. It's more the books that are about biographies of people in the past and how they done certain things. And then just being really common sense. So like we listen to the people. We actually involved every single employee into the process. And we told them, like, what can we do better for you? And we got to a place where the team is very strong. And we actually have quite significant competitive advantage against others, because we do the complete opposite of most Silicon Valley. We have work-life balance. We don't work over 40 hours. We don't work nights and weekends. Any of these things are not happening, you know? So it's kind of working well for us. And it was a process. So, I mean, we are almost 7 years old. So it was not always this way, but now it is.
Are you going to charge up your phone? Is that why you're walking around?
I was moving from the kitchen.
Why? Someone just got in there?
Yes, my wife.
How's working from home been for you?
Not easy. I personally preferred the office, but we got a pretty good pattern, and we shut down the offices forever. So we are now a remote only company.
I saw that on your hiring page.
Yes, the good thing, the interesting thing about that is, I will say half of our office is at this point moving or in process of moving or already moved somewhere. And so we took advantage of that and we started moving every single week for like 200 miles or so. And so every week we explore a new place and we move a little bit further.
So this isn't your, that's why you ended up in Salt Lake. I was Googling you to figure out, why is he in Salt Lake? Is there a thing? No, that's just part of you exploring the world.
Exactly. So next week we will start Colorado.
Wow. All right, let me take a moment to talk about my second sponsor. It's a company called HostGator. By the way, when I was looking you up, Rusty, one of the things that I brought up was a website that you built, I don't know how long ago. It's got like four articles on it and a list of books, right? The latest article was written 2017. So it's five articles. The earliest was from 2015. The latest 2017. You do have a bookshelf with, oh, I actually don't even see a list of books on here. There are no books on this. It's just a link to bookshelf. Here's the point though. I found it. It was one of the top things that I looked at when I was trying to understand you. And the reason I bring that up is I think most people do not understand how much they are being Googled, how much they're being looked at by everybody. We're setting up a small pod. We hired a teacher. We're getting a couple of my kids' friends into a garage, which should be safe, and a park, which will definitely be safe for them to sit with the teacher that we hired and learn. You can bet that every one of those parents was Googling me and saw my personal website, saw my work website. We're all being Googled. Clients are Googling you. Potential friends are Googling everybody. So the reason I'm bringing this up is, yes, I've talked in the past about how if you need a website for your business, you should go to HostGator.com/Mixergy. I'm going to tell you that right now, just go and create a site for you. It doesn't even have to have this cool domain like you do. What do you have? You have Turek.co, right?
Yep.
But it's spelled, it's spelled right. It doesn't even have to have a great domain. It just has to have your freaking name in it. And you know that when a client looks for you, now you get to represent yourself the way you want. Get a basic template. Is this a template even? It's nothing. It looks
it's a build, yeah.
It's just straight up black and white with purple on your name. That's it. That's all it takes. It's even better when it's like that because it makes it easier for people to look you up. And then put links to three or four things that you care about, even if it's just two of your hobbies, what you do for work, and then one other thing that you want to highlight. The less, the better, I find. Just think, if somebody's researching me because they wanted to, pot up with me, or if they're researching me because they want to buy from me, what do I want to show them? It's an unfair advantage that gives you a huge, huge, huge benefit. And if you go to HostGator.com/Mixergy, you'll get HostGator's already low prices, reduced even further. It's the lowest price that they have available. And you'll get unlimited disk space, unmetered bandwidth, email addresses, which frankly helps also. My wife and I have an email address that's a joint because every time somebody emails us, did you get it? Did you forward it to me? No. Now I have one email address for both of us. We can both check it. No headaches. You can do all of that for super inexpensive at HostGator.com/Mixergy. And oh yeah, if you do want to start a website for your business, go to HostGator.com/Mixergy too. You hate your hosting company, switch over. They'll help you move. HostGator.com/Mixergy. Everything. All right. What do you think of that ad? Are you a person who loves ads? I know we talked about how when you were a kid, you loved business and I saw your eyes light up when you talked about it. Did you used to watch infomercials the way that I did to just to watch how the sales process worked?
Well, I grew up in a communistic era. And so we were not allowed to have any Western stuff. And so when the communism ended, we started getting German channels and it was so strikingly different. So my first ever movie was Home Alone. That was my first American movie I ever seen. It came out essentially the Christmas as it came in the US. It was one of the largest purchases of the television. And we were all watching it. We had single channel in the whole country and we were all watching it. And what killed us was multiple things. Like for instance, they had all of these Christmas lights outside of the on the house. And we just couldn't believe that someone puts lights on the outside. And then what was the absolutely staggering experience was when little Kevin takes his food from the fridge, puts it into this little oven, and in 30 to 60 seconds, it's done. And it's called microwave. We never saw microwave before. And so we were sitting there with our mouth open, and it's like living this future life now, right? And so when I was growing up, I was watching all of these German channels, mostly for cartoons, but then they always, you know, showed all of these commercials, and it always looked better. Like, all of the communistic stuff was like simple design because they had no competition, there was no marketing. And then you had these mini sausages, and you see this kid smiling as they are eating it. And it's like, I want to be the smiling kid.
And what country most was of this? My
Slovakia.
What year was this?
It was like 1992.
Okay, well,
3 years after the communist era ended.
And so, did you want to partake? I know your dad was an entrepreneur. What type of entrepreneur was he?
I think he still is. He started a company to essentially, he bought up a company from the like from the post-communistic era or from the communistic era for that was making tractors. And so they still own it and they still produce tractors. And it's really? The, I think, second largest company in the world producing tractors or third after John Deere and Caterpillar. So it's he was, you know, he's mechanical engineer. Both of my parents are mechanical engineers. And it was really interesting to see how they struggled to learn business because communism didn't allow any business, right? So everything was owned by the state. There was no competition. And essentially all products that you bought were provided by the state and they were always in one. So you had one type of anything. You couldn't have more. And so when the communist era ended, but now you had three companies doing the same thing, they didn't know that there is such a thing as a marketing. And so a lot of things were learned the hard way, like from scratch. And I saw, watched my dad essentially trying to figure out how to actually sell services that are not necessarily mandatory, right? Like if you wanted to have a tractor, you could go to someone else and buy it, not necessarily just from you.
How did he learn how to do this? What did you watch as he learned? What did you learn from him?
He struggled. I mean, they struggled extreme amount. In fact, I remember when our IRS showed up, we didn't have IRS before because you don't need to file taxes when the state is the only one paying you. Like, what taxes do you need, you know? And so when IRS showed up and they started saying, these are going to be the rules, people didn't know what the double books, double accounting means or any of these things. And so they had to learn everything from scratch. And don't forget, there are no books about these topics. You can't go to a library and get a book and read about it because they were not allowed. And so it took a decade, I will say, to learn even the absolute basics for them.
And did you then want to be an entrepreneur watching him struggle? Or did you say, this is actually not for me?
I loved the idea. I the struggle was something that I was not really privy of. Like, it was not that visible to me. I see it as a kind of from the hindsight. But as a kid, that's not what your parents expose you to. What I did see is how my dad was making the business, and it felt like he doesn't do anything. He just goes, meets new people and talks to them, and somehow that's the business. And I felt that's the most ingenious thing that can happen. Like, you don't have to do physically anything. You just talk to people. And I felt that was magical. And since I was very, very little, I wanted to be badly entrepreneur. And I tried to do so many things, from selling stickers to my classmates through running a food business and stuff like that. Whatever I called and will generate money, I was very, very happy with it. And it's also how I learned accounting. Like, you learn the basic of ledger, who owes you money, what collection looks like, and any of those things. And you also hire the muscle, right? Like, so when I was in the fifth grade, I hired ninth graders to collect my money for me for, you know, fraction of whatever was there. And it was interesting experience.
That is fun. You built up your business. You did this tweet that's now a pinned tweet on your account. 2019, what was the monthly recurring revenue?
Yeah, we closed with over $1 million.
Over $1 million recurring monthly revenue. You had about 60 people on the team. You ended that tweet for the year saying 2020 is shaping up to be significantly better considering COVID. I'm still assuming it did better, right, than last year.
It's shaped to do way better than last year.
Way better. Yes. Where are you guys with revenue now?
We are hovering around the same number, but mostly because we streamlined the operations to focus on the new opportunities. And so, as you mentioned at the beginning, the world is changing. And so we are kind of dividing the core into two operations and doing a little bit more there. And that is slowing the core revenue for us.
And the new product is, the one that we just discussed is called Discover. The new product is called Attribution Engine. There's something called Article 15, which I've heard
people call...
It's currently
called 17.
Is it 17 now?
Yes.
Okay. What is this article? I've heard it called the link tax.
Well, so Article 15 is, in fact, the link tax. Article 17 is a little bit different. So there's a new law, which is called European Copyright Directive, which European Union doesn't have laws. It has directives, which are more like a frameworks, that then every state has to implement internally. And so this directive is changing how essentially rights have to be dealt with on the internet, let's call it. And so Article 17, which is more relatable to our business, is essentially shifting the liability, or it's kind of putting new liability on the platforms, which what that means, essentially, YouTube currently, any video that is uploaded to them is not liable for it. Whatever the video does, whatever it contains, it's not YouTube's problem. If a rights holder identifies the video on that platform and finds out that video essentially holds something in there that is of the rights holder can now issue what they call a takedown notice, meaning I don't want this to be on this platform. In certain platforms like YouTube, they can go and say, you know, I actually don't want to take this down, but I also want to be paid. So YouTube can do that. However, the new law is essentially shifting this to YouTube now needs to license that content before it's published. So it needs to explicitly know who it belongs to as the user is uploading it before it allows it to be published on the platform. So
because
it's not.
If I take Taylor Swift's latest music video and I upload it to my YouTube channel, in the past, Taylor Swift's people could have said, hey, YouTube, take it down. And as long as YouTube took it down, they were fine. Today, if YouTube lets me upload it, after this law passes, what's the danger to YouTube? What happens?
Well, so if YouTube lets it upload it, but it doesn't know it belongs to Taylor Swift, Taylor Swift can sue for statutory damages and additional fines, which can amount to €85,000 per infringement.
Per infringement. Okay. And so now they have a bigger need to know ahead of time, is every bit of content that they publish, is there someone who owns a copyright on it?
Correct.
And do it in real time.
Do it in real time at the scale of theirs, right? So they get 600 hours of content every minute, around 10 hours a second. And so that means they have to analyze 10 hours of content a second, which is quite heavy and challenging. And obviously YouTube is not one of many hundreds of platforms. And so you have big ones from Facebook, Instagram, TikTok and such, but you have many small ones that are still in aggregate quite significant when it comes to scale.
And Rusty, I talk about Madonna, Lady Gaga, Taylor Swift, but even Andrew Warner, right? If somebody takes my content and republishes it to YouTube, I have a case against YouTube, against Google.
Exactly.
Wow. All right. And so then what are you doing to help YouTube with this and frankly, to make some money from it?
So we built what we call Visa for Digital Rights. It works like the Visa card. So the idea is we bring three-sided marketplace together, creators, rights holders, and platforms, and we settle the licensing at the point of publishing. So what that means is the user goes, as of always, uploads the video to YouTube, is filling up all of these titles and other stuff. And by the time they are done filling it out, the video goes through us. We make all of these identifications. We look at what the rights holders actually had as an intent in our system. So for instance, Taylor Swift or whoever is owner of her rights comes to our system and says, if you find this song in this situation on this platform, I want to do X in this territory. So for instance, in the Taylor Swift case, they could say, if you find this song played in this video, and it's on YouTube, I want to monetize in all of these territories but China. In China, I want to block. And so essentially, we then go and issue this license back to YouTube and tell YouTube what has to happen in each of these regions, essentially. And then if YouTube follows it, the liability is then taken away from them and we cover it. So it's kind of an insurance rather than a technical play.
And this will happen. What I'm trying to understand then is, what happens if Taylor Swift doesn't do it, if her people don't say anything ahead of time?
Well, then the platform is not liable up until they show up. So the law requires both parties to cooperate. That means Taylor Swift and whoever owns the rights has to cooperate with the platform in the first place, or meaning with us. And if they do, then they are able to get paid or whatever they are requiring. But if they don't cooperate with the platform, then they have no case.
And so now you will be the marketplace, because as I understand with Discover, you provide the software. Big content owners work directly with you, but smaller ones work through third parties, through smaller independent software companies, right?
Yes.
Got it. And so now you're going to be the middleman sitting there with the marketplace where, and am I going to have to come on your platform and then register my stuff?
Yes.
I will. And so now you have to create every a whole consumer person. Facing experience.
Yes. And it's completely free to all creators and rights holders.
All I have to do is say, here's all my content. And now this is what I want you to do whenever that happens.
Exactly.
And do you have any experience creating consumer facing content?
I will hope so. My previous company was in consumer facing. We did the recommendation as a service. So Netflix like recommendations for, like, imagine IMDb more social.
This is Synopsy.
Synopsy, yeah.
Everywhere I see, and I know we need to close this out, but everywhere I see you, you're known as Synopsy. Your Twitter account, Synopsy. LinkedIn account, Synopsy. This is a company that didn't work out for you.
Yes.
Does
it
hurt?
It's a historical residue. Yeah.
Does it hurt?
I mean, it's not easy, right? I can see the why it didn't work out. And at the end of the day, it's like it was a good experience, but it's not simple, right? I don't pay too much attention to it anymore, but
You can go to Twitter and change your name. You've got something about domain names. You could go and get a great name on Twitter, on LinkedIn, but I feel like you're doing this intentionally. Are you doing it to hurt yourself and remind yourself not to make a mistake?
I just have it as a historic. So, I mean, I created those accounts, you know, I think I have Twitter from 2008, at least this account I have 2008. I think I have other one from 2006, LinkedIn from as long. And so they're just historical there. And a lot of people know me, especially in the Central European region, know me by that nickname. So I still go by that. I'm in transition to use my first name as a basic nickname everywhere. The problem is, like, I don't want on Twitter, I can change it to Rusty, but I don't want anyone else to use Synopsy. And that's kind of the challenge there, right? So it's like, I don't want people to have those nicknames that I utilize now.
Because?
It's just, I still have the domains. I still have all of the trademarks and everything else there. So it's like, it's kind of part of, and my might. If this company works out really well and I decide to go and do something else, I might put something else there.
Yeah, I think you used that name twice with two different companies. Am I right?
Yeah. I sold the previous one and they didn't want the name.
What did you pay for pex.com?
Lower tens of thousands, surprisingly.
Really?
It took me, yes.
Under $50,000 for a three-letter name?
Yeah.
How?
It took me 9 months. I created an anonymized Gmail account. I started writing the owner for a couple of months, and I was coming back and forth, and I convinced him that it's in his best interest to do it with me, and he did.
Why? Why was it in his best interest to sell to you?
Well, I try to, as with everything I do in business, I try to understand the person on the other side. So this gentleman is out of Japan, and he had some financial troubles, and I try to be compassionate about that, and I was trying to figure out if I can be of help, and I was able to, you know, match what he needed, and he was willing to sell it for lower amount of money because it was more friendship at that point than it was a business transaction.
How'd you become friend with him over email?
I emailed constantly. I was just curious about him. I didn't even ask him about the domain. When he said the first time he's not interested in selling, I was like, if you don't mind, I would like to get you know you a little bit better and try to understand the person that you are essentially trying to make a transaction with. Because as you know, it's much easier to do business with friends than it's with strangers.
All right. Well, thanks for being on here. I hope this brings us a little bit closer to friendship. But man, I admire what you built now. Now that I get a sense of what it is. I don't think I fully understood it until I started researching you and doing this interview. All right. For anyone who wants to go check out the site, it's PEX. When's the attribution engine launching?
end of the year for public. We are in process of changing the page. So PEX will be now attribution engine only, essentially. And it's what we are doubling down when it's, so it's going to be, yeah, next four to five months, it shall be up.
So a new domain name then for the new business?
No, it's PEX.com.
Oh, it will be. Okay. All right. PEX.com. And I want to thank the two sponsors who made this interview happen. If you need to get a website hosted, and believe me, you do, go to hostgator.com/Mixergy, super low and very effective. And if you want to hire top developers, the kind that will just make you smile the way the Rasti was smiling here in this interview with pride, like, yeah, I built that. We own that. We did that. That's where you want to go to talk to toptal.com/Mixergy. Finally, I'm going to recommend something to you, Rasti. If you still care about culture, there is this guy, Scott Bintz. I interviewed him. He's a guy who just sells car truck parts on the internet. Got it to a few million dollars, wasn't really enjoying life, said, I got to go to work at a place where I love it. He went to Google to look at their culture, went to Zappos, went to other companies, figured out what he was going to do to create a right culture for him, wrote a book that's so underappreciated. I forget the name of the book. His name is Scott Bintz, though. Look it up in the Amazon store, where he said, here's how I did it. Got his business up to $100 million in revenue, and then he sold it. And I know him because he did a course. If anyone out there has Mixergy Premium, you guys are going to love his course where he talked about how to do it. It's amazing. All right. Highly recommend his book or the course or talking to him, and I'll be happy to make an intro for you. But you're doing well. You're smiling. So congratulations. Thanks for being on here. And thanks for doing this.
Thank you for having me.